My name again is Byron Swanson. We're talking about liberation theology. This is our third session. And the topic tonight is liberation theology, is it communistic? And those of you that have been here before will be bored for a few minutes, but I think it might be helpful if I just very quickly run through this outline that you can't see so that you'll have some sort of a recall. Sound barrier, so that you'll have either a recall if you have been here before, or if you haven't, you'll have some sort of a brief and very inadequate introduction. You're new, first time you've been here, is that right? I mean, new to the discussion. Who else is new the first time? Okay, so we got several people that need to be brought up today. If you can see, that says liberation theology. And very quickly, liberation theology is a unique theology that has mushroomed in the last couple of decades. We talked the first time whether it was any longer thought of as a fad, or if indeed now it's an out-and-out revolution. We won't get into that tonight, but I'm inclined to think, along with most people in the world, that we've got a revolution on our hands. And whether you're interested in it or sympathetic with it or not doesn't really make a lot of difference. It's here. It's half the world is involved in it, is excited about it, is finding it either meaningful or something that's very objectionable. And it's very important, therefore, I think, for those of us who are sitting nice and comfortably here or wherever we happen to be spending most of our time to know something about liberation theology. It involves, again, oppressed people. It begins wherever there's oppression, and that means we've been focusing on people in Latin America, because I've been going down there the last three Januaries working on this, but we could also talk about blacks. They're having so much more fun than me. So it could be third world countries such as in Latin America or South Africa, or blacks in this country, women in this country. So what my wife is talking about when she talks about feminist theology or feminist issues is a part of this whole movement. It's just one little one big category under this umbrella. It involves gay people that also are asking for liberation because of their oppression, which has gone on for thousands of years. And we talked a couple days ago about how it even involves the environment. This is the newest aspect of liberation theology, where nothing is more powerless, oppressed, marginal. These are all words that people use when they talk about oppressed people. Nothing's more marginal or pushed out of it than is our environment. All of us are trampling the environment, and worst of all, even the oppressed oppress the environment. So anyway, all of these people and things that are being oppressed are a part of this new theology, which is taking over, which is saying that we've got to do something to liberate those who are oppressed.
Did you really mean to imply that half the people of the world are knowledgeable of liberation theology?
Did I say that?
Or excited about it?
I probably shouldn't have, because I've had several people up here. If I did say that, strike them.
I thought it was a little far.
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is that half the people in the world are oppressed,
right,
if not more. Those are the people that... not all of them, of course, are Christians, and not all of them, of course, are involved in liberation theology. But grandiose sort of statements have been made about this theology, suggesting that it is, without a doubt, the most influential theology of certainly the last half of the 20th century. Even more important, more influential than something like Vatican II in the Roman Catholic Church. So anyway, you keep correcting me. I need to be corrected. When I talk real quickly, because I always have so much I want to share or talk about, and I want you to talk, that I have a tendency to say things that ought to be corrected. So you keep doing that. Anyway, we've got oppressed people. That's step number one environments. That's step number one in understanding liberation theology. Step number two is that if you're a person, what has happened is that these oppressed people tend to get together to form what has been called base Christian communities. And these base Christian communities are basically made up of lay people, not called together by the church, not called together by some priest who says, let's get together and have a little study session. But it's sort of a groundswell coming out of the grassroots, people who say, The Bible now, and I'm talking, again, keep in mind, primarily of Central and Latin America, where all of a sudden, because of Vatican II, the Bible has been made available to them. They get together, and they start talking about the Bible and reading the Bible. For many of them, it's the first time to be exposed to the Bible. I want to come back and give an illustration of that somebody gave me at dinner time tonight. But anyway, as they read the Bible, their methodology or hermeneutics or approach is basically to say, what did the Bible say back then? Again, keeping in mind that for many of them it's fresh, new, something they've never been exposed to before except through the mouth or eyes of a priest who will read to them or talk to them about selective things that might interest the priest. Anyway, what did it mean back then? What does it mean to us now? And then thirdly, they get into, on the basis of what it means to us now, we've got to do something. We've got to act on it. And that action is what is called praxis, which always involves that internalizing and thinking. It's not just going out and practicing, but praxis is always thinking, and out of your thinking and out of your discussions, action that takes place. When we met yesterday, was it yesterday? It's been a long time. We talked about this. We read the Bible, and I'm afraid I pushed it on you. I didn't give you enough time to discuss. But let's just take a second and stop at this particular point. You mentioned something at dinner tonight, Howard, about something new you had discovered.
I just mentioned that this morning, I don't do this very often, but I just opened my Bible and started reading as I did. And sure enough, it was James 5, the first six verses, which sounds to me like liberation theology. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have rusted, and their rust will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure for the last days. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have killed the righteous man. He does not resist you.
Okay, that's a great example. And those of you that were here the other day maybe remember some of the other examples. We simply walked through very quickly a whole bunch of passages in the first half of Luke. And the reason we took Luke is because Barbara Rossing is using that for her Bible studies. And as I was going to her Bible studies every night, I was absolutely amazed. I shouldn't have been amazed, but I continually am amazed that everything she was saying is exactly what liberation theology says. You know, text after text, morning after morning. So I decided when it was our turn to use a text, we'd just read Luke 2. And it just jumped out at us. Now, those of you that were here, if you want to disagree, if you've had a day to think about it and you say, wait a minute, we were manipulating the text, or it really doesn't say that, speak up now, or we'll make that assumption that that's pretty much where liberation theology is. Oppressed people getting together in small groups, mostly lay groups, just people. Rarely do they have a priest with them or a leader, somebody that really knows what he or she is talking about. And as they read the Bible, and in my case, we've been meeting with base Christian communities, where I've said this a couple of times, now forgive me, but where it's older people who have never even learned to read, and their little children are reading the Bible to them in these groups, it just absolutely sends chills through you as you realize how excited they are. But as they read the Bible, it keeps jumping out at them that as oppressed people, God is concerned for them, cares for them, loves them, and wants to liberate them from their oppression again and again and again. Our problem is, or at least my problem is, I've been reading the Bible all of my 100 years through the eyes of somebody who's male and white and middle class and a USA citizen. I've never been oppressed in my life, and I don't see those things that oppressed people see. It's there, but I've got to look for it. And when I look for it, it's like a new Bible, like I've never read it before. Anyway, that's where we were as of yesterday. Any quick comments on the parts of those of you who were here yesterday and might want to add, agree, or disagree? Did the Bible say that? Say those kind of things you were here, that you were here yesterday.
Yes.
Morning.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's great. Any more you want to say?
Because the people of Christ are oppressed also.
Yeah, great. Okay, now, so far, probably not too controversial, except it really is controversial, even this, because how many of us really trust lay people to open the Bible and to read it and to go out and act on the basis of what they, people who can't even read, like having little children read it to you, how many of us really trust those people with the Bible and expect that they're going to understand what a sophisticated, educated theologian who's had 4 years of college and 4 years of seminary and 4 or 8 years of graduate study. You know, those are the people that ought to be reading the Bible and giving it to us, right? Can we really trust these people? The marginal people, the exploited people, the wretched of the earth, the oppressed people. Well, that might be controversial. And I think those people who are in power, those people who are educated and think they do know it all, certainly do feel threatened. But wow, we've got a revolution. We've got a revolution that's taking place. We've only gotten down to A under Roman numeral 2, those of you that can't see it. Okay, now, B is where it really gets controversial, because B says, once they've read the Bible, and once they've come to the conclusion that it's time to start acting, praxis, that Latin word, then the action looks like this. They do things like, can you read that? What's it say?
Study Marx.
They study Marx. We've got to wrestle with that tonight. That's our project. We're going to come back to that in a second. What could be more controversial for many people who look at liberation theology the minute they get to that point, that these are Christians who are literally or actually studying Marx? It just causes them to... I'm going to make this dramatic, to close the book and to close the doors or to kick them out or to sweep them under the rug and to dismiss the whole thing. And that's our assignment tonight. We've got to wrestle with this because liberation theologians do look at Marx, and we've got to look at Marx too. Secondly, they act politically. We won't take time to talk about that. That may or may not be something that's... a concern for you, but for many of us as we've grown up in the church, that's been a no-no also. The church is not a place for politics. The church is a place for spirituality, saving souls, and so forth. But there are people who are oppressed who are saying, as they get together and as they read the Bible, how can we get liberated from our oppression? And among other things, it's inevitable. It's essential. There's got to be some political action. And there is. And that's a part of their agenda. They act, anybody read this word?
Subversively.
And just real quickly for those of you who are new, that simply means the versive is the verb for change. Sub, of course, means to change from below, as over against superversive, which would mean to change from above. And the problem is that they've been waiting for thousands of years or hundreds of years or however long for change from above, which never happens. And the conclusion that liberation theologians have come to is that if there's going to be any change at all, it's got to happen from the grassroots, from below. So we have to have subversion, subversiveness. That's the only way anything is ever going to change. We just don't have to worry about that tonight. We'll have to talk about it the next couple of days if you're interested. In some cases, number four, some theologians and liberation theologians actually come to the conclusion that you must use violence, that things just are not going to change if violence is not used. Probably our best example right now that all of us are aware of is, maybe China. I've lost contact with how it kept me up to date, but evidently there are some deaths now in China. I don't know if anybody's read the newspaper from the last day, but the students were acting peacefully, but I guess they were, I don't know, I shouldn't get into that. So let's take South Africa. All the violence in China is taking place since I got here, and I'm not informed. But in South Africa, after a generation or two of the blacks under apartheid waiting for some superversive change, which has never taken place, they've started trying to get change from below, and who can be surprised that South Africa today is involved in violence? And liberation theologians step back and say, is there any other way that any change is ever going to take place? Will the system ever break? Ever change? And that's something that many theologians say, I can't go that far. But some liberation theologians will. fifth one is they think existentially, and that simply is to say things like, God is on the side of the poor and the oppressed. To be existential means that you're to experience something in your real life, and they've experienced in Scripture and in their own lives that God is on the side of the poor and that God is not on the side of the oppressor. That's a little bit about existentialism. We won't talk about that now. But finally, the last thing that is involved is that they're working for the kingdom of God on earth, and even there's even some controversy in that, because a lot of us have grown up thinking that there's never going to be a kingdom of God on earth. The only time that's going to happen is when we all die and when Christ returns, and then the kingdom of God will be ushered in. But here are people who are so desperate, so wretched, so marginal, so non-persons, that's what they're called, that they're longing for this kingdom of God now, for some change, for something that's going to say we can start living while we're still alive, not waiting until we die. By the way, that's what we'll be talking about Friday. The fundamentalists and Pentecostals in Central America have said, we'll give you salvation when you die, and the people are flocking to that also. So there's a big tension between fundamentalism, which says, wait till you die, then you get your glory, and the liberation theology, which says, we want you to have it now. But tonight, again, our topic is, to all the laughter, if you have anything at all that's said about that, what are we going to talk about tonight? Communism. Okay, let me get you started. I'm going to tell you two quick examples of our introduction to the fact that liberation theologians use Marx. And I'm going to give negative introductions or negative statements, because I think in all honesty, that's probably what's going through most of your minds, right? Do any of you feel good about this so far? Do you say good for them, or great, or wow, that's wonderful? They read Marx. They study Marx. Just tell me kind of in your gut, how do you feel about this first step? Does it tend to turn you off toward liberation theology, or does it tend to turn you on?
Scares me.
Off? Off?
I don't know enough about Marx. I haven't read enough Marx to know.
So you're neutral?
Sounds like they're leaving their Christianity behind.
Okay, yeah. We want to hear that. Anybody else?
I would say it's inevitable. I really have no feeling good or bad about it. Uh-huh. It's just that it's inevitable that they will.
All right.
I have some little wishy-washy here, but on the one hand, I've been taught that the one thing that Karl Marx has to tell us that we need to listen to, and Latin America is carrying the weight of exploitation, which they call the exploitation of capitalist powers. Mm-hmm. And so if that be the case, if they're to be knowledgeable about this whole process, because it's an economic thing we're talking about, if they're to be knowledgeable, then they need to know the capitalism and to know what the critics are saying. Mm-hmm. Although the World Council of Churches has been criticized for supporting those who have done this thing. But the other thing was that I was in East Berlin 30 years ago in a Lutheran church, the downtown Lutheran church, in a student movement all evening for 5 hours. And in that evening, part of the time was give and take 3 hours of questions from me to them and back and forth. And one question they asked me was, have you read Karl Marx? Have you read Das Kapital? I said, no. And they said, you don't even know your enemy?
Yeah, that's right.
You're not willing to study your enemy? Mm-hmm. How can you act intelligently? And I said, no. They said, have most of Americans read Das Kapital? I said, no, but generally the only ones who have read it are PhDs in economics. They couldn't believe that we could be that stupid and still condemn Marx, whom we haven't even read.
Yeah. And we call ourselves Christians, and many of us, or most of us perhaps, haven't even read the Bible.
And they were required to read. They were required to read Marx each year in order to go on the next year in college.
Okay, I want to get into this in a little bit in depth. That's going to be my first assignment for you: is to come up with what you think Marxism means. And Howard has already started us off in that. But I think I get the feel from most of you that you're not really comfortable with this first step that liberation theology is willing to take. They're willing to take a look at Marx, to learn from Marx, to sit at the feet of Marx. And I'll give you two reactions that are at least experiences that have been a part of my life. And then I'll ask you to get yourselves involved again. About a year ago, at California Lutheran University where I teach, we had a art display. You had your hand up. I talked right to you.
Hold on a little. I think you wait till later.
Okay, wait till later. Okay, don't forget to do it again. Anyway, they had an art display. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. In fact, I didn't even know it was there until after it'd been up for a while. But anyway, some Latin American artists had been putting some artwork up. Had some artwork that was being shipped around the country, and it was on display at our university for a few weeks or a month or something. And evidently, I don't even remember this, but evidently one of the art displays depicted Christ as a Marxist revolutionary. And we had a letter to the editor that was written to the local newspaper. I'm not going to read the whole letter to the editor. I'm just going to read the last paragraph so that you'll get a feel for this. He says, "As an alumnus of CLU, I object to the so-called art display in the library of posters depicting Christ as a Marxist revolutionary. I am deeply offended and shocked that a Christian school allows the exploitation of the gospel of Jesus Christ to promote the anti-Christian philosophy of the Sandinista communists. Let's keep CLU as California Lutheran University, not Comrade Lenin University." Okay, you sort of get a feel. And I think if many of you walked into that same library display, you might have the same reaction. You'd say, "Bravo, right on, good for this guy. He's saying exactly what you might think." Okay, the other example I want to give is that, as I told the people in the first session, I've only been involved in trying to work seriously on liberation theology for the last 3 years. And in those 3 years, I've taken student groups with the Center for Global Education out of Augsburg College in Minneapolis. First year to Mexico, and that was such a life-changing and such an important experience for me and for the students, that the next 2 years we've been going to Central America. So I'm new to all of this, and I don't know much more than you do, but I've been working hard on it these last 3 years. And I want to tell you just a little bit about the first year when we went down to Mexico, which would have been January 1987. The other 2 Januaries, again, to Central America. Just before we got there, about 1 week before we got there, there was a big liberation theology conference where all the leading voices in Central America liberation theology were present. And I'll read some names that might mean something to you, it might not. But anyway, people like Gutierrez, whom Howard has heard. Gutierrez, by the way, is from Peru. Bonino is from Argentina. Boff is from Brazil. And by the way, the Pope, these are all Roman Catholics, of course, and the Pope doesn't like them either because of what comes under Roman numeral 2b and even Roman numeral 2a.
Bonino's a Bible. Methodist, by the way.
Pardon?
Bonino's Methodist.
Oh, is he Methodist?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. But Boff is Roman Catholic because he was told by the Pope that he was not excommunicated, but he could not speak or write or teach, and still hasn't been cleared from that particular censorship. Anyway, they had just met in Mexico City and Cuernavaca, and where we went was Cuernavaca, where the Center for Global Education has a house. And by the time we got there, we found the walls in Cuernavaca and Mexico City covered with graffiti. And I'll pass this around. It was everywhere. And I've translated in case you can't read Spanish or the picture isn't good enough. But it says, "Catholic Mexico rejects Marxist theology." So you can just pass that around and see. That was my first introduction of the liberation theology 2 years ago or 3 years ago this past January. We went down to try to be introduced to this, and every street, it seemed like, had graffiti written on the walls that here were people, the Mexican people themselves, who were rejecting Marxist theology. Okay, now, with that in mind, I want to turn it over to you for a few minutes. And if we're recording still with all the noise, maybe you can turn it off for a few seconds. In a minute, you'll know when to turn it off. But what I'd like you to talk to your neighbor about for just a couple of minutes is two things. Number one, talk to each other and say, what does Marxism mean to you? How do you define Marxism? What is this thing that is so controversial, that is so hated, that is so despicable? that, you know, that we get graffiti on the walls, that we get people writing to our university saying, get that art out of here, and we don't want any more of that. This is a Christian, a Lutheran university. So number one, what is Marxism? And just Howard's already suggested something. He says that what he knows of it, that it's got something in it that says you shouldn't appreciate capitalism. And maybe that's what you think too, but what do you think? What is it, number one? And number two, I want you to talk to your neighbor and come to some sort of a conclusion. How in the world, after you define it, how in the world do you think, or why in the world do you think, that liberation theologians are infusing it or introducing it into their theology? Try to talk very quickly about those two things, okay? What is it, and why in the world is it a part of liberation theology? Okay, take 3-4 minutes, as long as you need. Don't get real in-depth. Just sort of talk off the top of your heads, and we'll see what comes up. Okay, we can turn off the PA system for a few minutes. Secretary, and we'll put this on the board, but tell me first of all, what do you think Marxism is? Let's just, you know, none of us, I suppose, are scholars in this particular area. None of us are experts, but goodness. Ever since I think I was in the teens or something, when did, 40s, in my less than teens, we've been in some sort of a Cold War with Marxists, right? It's been an obsession with us. Those are the bad guys, so we've got to know something about who they are. Who are they? Tell me what Marxism is. What comes into your mind when you say Marxism or communism?
Well, Marxism is a economic, socio-economic system where the idea is that the workers who produce things should be the owners, should own and manage the means of production.
Okay. I need to use the other half of the board, so we need to reduce things as much as we can. Can you reduce that to a couple words, or can the rest of you join in? The
workers, owners, managers.
Okay, is it accurate to say that this is maybe what Howard was talking about earlier when he was saying anti-capitalistic, because capitalism, of course, says I own and I can make as much as I want. So that's okay. It's got something in it that says capitalism is bad, okay? And because we got to have group ownership, not individual ownership. Okay, so we'll just put anti-capitalism. So I saw a hand up. Go ahead and talk.
Dictatorship of the proletariat.
Tell me what you mean by that. Tell us what
another
you mean.
Words, another way of saying what's just been said, that the workers will operate the government and operate the whole social order. Dictatorship of the proletariat. Proletariat means the workers.
Yeah, proletariat means the workers. Now, are we talking about Marx, or are we talking about some forms of communism that have maybe adapted some sort of a dictatorship? Does Marx, anybody know a lot about Marx?
He does.
Yeah. Is there a dictatorship that's built into the Marxist system, or isn't it to be a classless society?
Well, they actually call it the dictatorship of the proletariat, but that means that the mass of people rule the system.
Okay, so what you're really saying is another way, in very, very brief form, it's anti-capitalistic. Yeah. Instead of a few people owning lots and controlling others, that you would have general control and ownership by all. Okay, what else comes to mind when you think of Marxism?
Anti-God.
All right, atheist. All right, atheism. Want to say any more there?
Nope.
Is that saying enough? Yeah, now we've really got something. If Marx is an atheist, no God, we're really scratching our heads and asking ourselves, how can Christian liberation theologians study Marx? Now, this is a toughie, right?
Because he has a political, Marx was a very good political theoretician, and they're using his political theories.
Okay, we're going to try to come up with the answers in a little bit, but let's get the problems out in front of us now. Maybe that first one is a problem, maybe it isn't, but By the way, on this atheism thing, the famous statement that you're all familiar with that comes from Marx is that Christianity is the opium of the people, the opiate of the people. And of course, that's going to be a part of our discussion probably on Friday also. That Christianity traditionally, down through the centuries, has told its followers that are oppressed. Just like the parable of the rich man who has the poor man, Lazarus, sitting at his gate, hoping that a few crumbs will be thrown out to him. The traditional Christian response to the oppressed people has been, wait till you die, and then you'll get your reward. And in that parable, if you remember, that's what happens. The poor man with all the open sores and the wild dogs come and lick him and so forth. The poor man sits at the rich man's gate, just hoping the rich man will throw out a few crumbs. The way I've heard this story is that you didn't have napkins, so often the wealthy would just simply take bread to get the grease off of their hands because you'd eat with your fingers and so forth, and you just throw the bread aside. And the poor man sits there hoping that just a few crumbs of bread will fall near him so that he can survive. Finally, they both die. Who goes to heaven? The poor man, Lazarus. Who goes to hell? The rich man. And that's been typically the answer that the Christian church has given to oppressed people. And Marx comes along in the 19th century and he sees what Christians are doing to the poor and the oppressed. And he says, Christianity is nothing more than opium. It's a drug to drug people so that they'll endure their hopelessness, their oppression now, and that they'll finally get their reward when they die and go to heaven. And he says, I, however, suggest, as he does dramatically in that last line or the last page, last paragraph of the Communist Manifesto, his proposition is, workers, proletariat, workers of the world, arise. You have nothing to lose but your chains. That's right. Why in the world accept an opium which is going to drug you and give you a reward only after you die? Follow me and we'll get rid of those chains that are enslaving you and oppressing you. And in 100 years, guess what? Marxism has taken over because of that that appealing voice of Marx. 100 years, Marxism has gained one-third of the world's population, the same that has taken Christianity 2,000 years to do, one-third of the world's population. So there's something in Marx. We got to know about this guy, right? And we got to try to understand why liberation theology reads it. But anyway, he's an atheist. He says, Christianity does nothing but drug the people. And if you follow me, I'm going to give you life. Okay, no. I was just going to say,
you drew us a triangle yesterday. Mm-hmm. Church, military, wealthy. Mm-hmm. These three elements have been controlling Latin America. Mm-hmm. This is a new movement within the Catholic Church primarily.
Liberation theology.
Liberation theology is. And it says, just because the church has represented the military and the wealthy, mm-hmm. this is no reason to reject God. But God has something else to say. Mm-hmm. And I believe that in studying Marx, they are not embracing his atheism.
Okay, hold on to that. We want to get one more point down. Then we're going to try to understand and figure it out. So come back and pick that up in a minute. I shouldn't have cut you off already. But there's at least one other thing that you need to say about Marxism. You're doing great so far. It is anti-capitalistic because capitalism stands for dog-eat-dog, survival of the fittest. There's a lot of... I hate to do this now, but those of you who were here yesterday, it's not that capitalism is not the kind of stuff you read about in Luke. It's not the kind of stuff for 3 days in a row Barbara Rossian has been telling us about, right? Who are the kind? What kind of? Do we have a dog eat dog survival of the fittest? Everybody out for him or herself in Luke?
No, sharing.
It's all sharing and losing yourself and taking care of the poor, the maimed, the blind, inviting the Levites to dinner. The scum of the earth, all of this kind of stuff. And capitalism doesn't do that. Capitalism says, I'm out for my own, I want to make profit, and I'm in competition with you, and if I win, you're going to lose, but that's great for me, and the rich get richer, and the poor get poorer, and it's that whole thing, and Marx looks at it.
And a case can be made that capitalism is atheistic, for it worships the god Mammon.
Yeah, you could. Okay, but there's one more thing we need to say about Marxism. What else does it stand for? I think maybe I heard you say it. Go ahead.
Well, it's revolutionary. It preaches revolution or the overthrow.
Okay. Okay. It advocates revolution, or we'll call it class struggle. Is that what you? Is that okay to use those words? Okay. Which is exactly what we said when I quoted the last part of the Communist Manifesto. Workers of the world, arise, you have nothing to lose but your chains. What Marx is advocating is that people not wait till they die to get their reward. But he's advocating that people struggle now, and as they struggle, they can somehow overcome their hopelessness, overcome their oppression, and improve their situation. And that's a part of it. Okay, I think that those are probably the three basic things that we need to pinpoint in a very superficial way as we try to understand Marx. That's what it is, in a very superficial way. Why do you think, on the basis of what we said, why do you think liberation theologians have introduced it into their Christian theology? Remember where they start now. I have this outline on purpose, and hopefully you can see it. Are your eyes getting adjusted to the dark? The first thing they do is what? When they get together in base Christian communities, they read the Bible. They're enthralled with the Bible, inspired by the Bible, motivated by the Bible, enlightened by the Bible. They believe with all their hearts that they can be liberated because of the things that the Bible tells them. Okay, now, with that in mind, tell me, on the basis of what we know, why liberation theologians return to Marx? Okay, why don't you all keep thinking for a second, unless somebody's ready to speak up. Anybody ready to speak up? Let me say one thing as a preface, because this I wouldn't expect you to know. One thing you got to understand, again, is the outline that I've given you on the board. And we've had that up for 3 days in a row now. And you just have to accept that. And we did that yesterday. That it begins with oppressed people. Number two, they get together, they form base Christian communities to do what? To read the Bible. And believe me, they do. We've got books and books and books. There are four volumes of this book where it's simply a collection of base Christian community groups, peasants, farmers, fishermen in Nicaragua, in Solentaname, who simply, it's just simply a collection of Bible verses that they've sat down and talked about. Little kids, old women, young men, four volumes of it. We've got, and in my case, every time that we've met, gone to Central America or Mexico, we've met with base Christian communities. And that's all they do. They sit and they read the Bible. I've never heard them talk about Marx. But anyway, they do that. But notice that that's A, from the Bible they are inspired to act, praxis, and action becomes only one of their activities is to look at Marx. So that tells you something right there. That which really is most important, the Bible or Marx?
The Bible.
Say it louder.
The Bible.
Okay, yeah, and I'm going to give some examples of that from a couple people, but first a question.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm beginning to form a picture here that this is really a political uprising. The Bible is their source of moral inspiration. Marx is the source of their strategy and the means to carry out the struggle.
Great. Okay, that's exactly it. Marx is used as a tool that tells them how oppressed people ought to organize themselves to do something about their oppression. It's a tool. It's simply that. And it really isn't very strong in them. Let me read a couple verses here. This is a Marxist, I mean, this is a liberation theologian who happens to be a Jesuit, who happens to be from Chile, and he is complaining about how people overemphasize the Marx in liberation theology and underemphasize the Bible in liberation theology. But let me just simply read it right from his mouth. Why do you put Marx and the Bible right up there together? We don't equate them that way. For us, the Bible provides us with our overall approach to life, while Marx is simply a useful, analytical tool within that biblical framework. It's all right to talk about Marx if you want to, but put him in the second paragraph, and that's where he is, right? Here's the first paragraph. These Christian communities read the Bible first, and you put him in the second paragraph. So, you did a beautiful job. It's a tool that they're going to use. Let me read just something else very quickly from another book. Contrary to a common stereotype in their writings, liberation theologians do not devote much time to discussing Marxism. He takes three people to illustrate it. One is a man, a liberation theologian, very famous, by the name of Segundo, who asserts that some of the best-known theologians have only a polite relationship with Marx. Only a polite relationship. Another one, John Sobrino. He has written 800 pages in his two major volumes on liberation theology, and there are only 9 references in 800 pages to Marx and none to any other Marxists. And finally, the third person that he refers to is Gutierrez, who is the father of the liberation theology, who comes out of Brazil, out of Peru, I'm sorry. And Gutierrez refers to a wide range of Marxist literature, but there are few such references in one of his books, The Liberation, Theology of Liberation. But in all the other books that he's written, there are hardly any references at all. So number one, as we continue our discussion now, we have to understand that they aren't substituting the Bible for Marx. The Bible is still the book. The Bible is still the inspiration. The Bible is still where it all is. That's where they begin, and that's really where they end. But if you're going to try to overcome your oppression, if you're going to be a part of a revolution, and don't be afraid of that word, as we've been reading Luke, it's revolutionary, isn't it? What were Jesus' words when he came to the synagogue and announced what he was going to do? Remember? Luke 4, we talked about it, those of you that were here the other day. It's absolutely revolutionary.
Good news to the poor.
That's right. Keep going. What else did he say?
In the acceptable year of the Lord.
That's right. I've come to bring good news to the poor. I'm proclaiming release to the captives. Somebody that's going to go in and release captives, that's revolutionary. Recovery of sight of the blind, that's not so bad. Set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And on and on. We read this for the whole hour yesterday. And it's revolutionary stuff. But anyway, if you're going to be a revolutionary, says these people in Central America, or says liberation theology, Marx is one of those people you have to read. Okay, now talk to me about it some more. Let's get some other things on the board. Atheism, therefore, is really... What are you going to say about atheism? Is that a factor at all?
Well, whenever I meet an atheist, mm-hmm. I ask him what kind of a God is that you don't believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And I would venture to guess, from what little knowledge I have of Karl Marx, that the God he rejects is the God that we would reject.
Yeah, probably would. But just so that it doesn't worry you, from what I've just read from two sources, and we really talked about 4 liberation theologians, Marx isn't referred to that often. But when they do refer to him, believe me, they never talk about atheism. We've been again to Nicaragua the last 2 Januaries, and I have never been which is a communist country, right? This summer in July, we're going to be the 10th year of the revolution, which brought which overthrew Somoza and introduced the present regime, which is ruled by the Sandinistas, and it's communistic. But believe me, the church, I've never been any place in my life where the church and Christianity is as alive and well as it is in Nicaragua. There's no talk about atheism. There's nobody even mentions it. The Christian faith is vibrant and exciting. That's where all these books are coming from. Nicaragua, from liberation theologians, so believe me, that atheism is not something they're picking up from Marx.
Excuse me for talking too much, but the student group in East Berlin were Lutherans,
mm-hmm.
strong Christians,
mm-hmm.
strong Christians.
Sure.
They all studied Karl Marx, sure. And they all rejected atheism.
All right, okay, so please do not worry about that one. All right, now, let's take our last two that we have. What about anti-capitalism? We've already sort of given some things away there, but why do you suppose there might be something in liberation theology that would be interested in a position that was anti-capitalistic? And maybe this is where you wanted to speak, or maybe not.
Well, I think just because of the way that Marxist-Leninist philosophy developed is that Lenin in particular added the idea that it was the imperialist imperative that was oppressing the people, and that it was the capitalists in the United States and other imperialist countries that were causing this the oppression of these people to occur. And so they see that as, through Marx's philosophy, see that as the reason for their oppression.
Okay, now I just looked at my watch, and don't you dare look at your watches, because we're running out of time. Just trust me, I'll let you go. But we're going to have to rush it a little bit. But yeah, exactly. Even as the book of Luke and the whole New Testament and the whole Old Testament talks about God's love and care and concern about the oppressed, there's something in our system of capitalism, and this is no black and white, easy answer. We all appreciate, I suppose, and are glad that we live in a capitalistic country. But we've got to admit, right, that there's something in capitalism that is oppressive. We've had to control it ourselves. We don't today, in the 20th century, have the same capitalism we had in the 19th century, when we had the robber barons, when capitalism ran wild, uncontrolled, unleashed, right? We realize that that the rich do get richer and the poor do get poorer. So we've got anti-monopoly laws, right, which says capitalism can absolutely devour people. It can crush people, and that therefore it must be controlled. And we understand that. And we've tried to get the best of both systems. But there's something in capitalism which is not found in the New Testament, in the Christian faith. The New Testament talks about being willing to die for the other person, being willing to give all that you have to the other person, agape love, which is selfless and forgiving. We don't have much forgiveness or selflessness in capitalism. It's a selfish. Well, I didn't see the movie last year, but the one that was up for Academy Award, where it was about Wall Street, is that what it was called, if any of you saw it? And the guy preaches his doctrine of greed is good. Mm-hmm. That's capitalism. And there's something in that that makes Marx maybe even more sensitive and insightful to the Christian faith than are those of us who embrace capitalism. So we can understand, and especially now, we're down in Central America, and capitalistic USA is coming down there and exploiting you, taking all your bananas, developing plantations for all the bananas are taking. By the way, I couldn't buy a banana in Nicaragua. They're all up here. If you want bananas, stay here, because all of them come up here. Down there, there's nothing. Just forget it. And coffee and all the rest of it. And we want I won't get into that. I'm not an economist. But we know what we do economically. And what we're doing is bleeding these countries and exploiting them so that we can have cheaper goods and better goods and all the rest of it. So there's something in there that is somewhat appealing to liberation theologians. But here's the big class struggle. Anybody know where Marx gets his ammunition? What philosopher, historian of the 19th century did Marx read and study and learn from? Anybody know? Hegel? Does Hegel mean anything to you? Real quickly on this, we're going to get a flood of noise and voices here, but I'll try to put this on the board. Hegel was an early 19th century philosopher who came up with a philosophy of history which is based on what is called a dialectic. Are you familiar with Hegel? Any of you? Anyway, the understanding of the dialectic understanding of history is that you always have a thesis which is always being challenged by an antithesis, antithesis, which, well, I'll put this on the board. Okay, you always have here, you always have here a thesis, a status quo, which is always being challenged by a, this is like this morning we were having Bible study in the fire line. So I'll talk about it and then I'll put it on the board later. you've always got a thesis which is being challenged by an antithesis, which in turn is going to, because of that struggle, there's your struggle, is going to lead to a what?
Synthesis.
Which is an improvement, it's a compromise. That new synthesis, here's the thesis, here's the antithesis, and it's going to lead to a new synthesis, which becomes a new thesis, which is going to be challenged by a new antithesis, which is going to lead to a new synthesis, which becomes a new thesis, which is going to be challenged again. And the point is, through that challenging, through that struggle, things always keep improving, always keep bettering themselves. The other day I used a terrible example, but I use it again because some of you heard it. What if Holden all of a sudden were to say, remember I said, you can't walk in the trails, we're going to close the trails, you can't play pool, you can't, we're only going to have one meal a day, and then you can only have a glass of juice or something like that, and a whole bunch of other ridiculous restrictions on us. We'd get together in our base Christian communities and we'd plot our action, what we were going to do. We would be opposed to this because they're oppressing us, right? And not only that, but then we'd probably go talk to the proper people. Here's the thesis, making these preposterous demands upon us, oppressing us. We would become the antithesis. We'd go talk to the proper people and you know, something would work out. They'd make some compromises, right? And we'd have a little bit better situation. But then all of a sudden, it wouldn't be perfect again, and we'd start the process over. And the whole Hegelian idea is that things just keep getting a little bit better and a little bit better, and that's the story of history. That all of history is made up of struggles. We are always opposing that which is oppressing us. And as we oppose it, some improvement takes place, and it keeps getting better and better and better. And Marx picks this up and introduces it into his Marxism so that the thesis is what? What's the thesis for Marx? That we are controlled by the upper classes, the wealthy, the heads. Who's going to oppose them? The proletariat, the lower class. And as the proletariat goes after the upper classes, the lower class goes after the upper classes as they struggle, what are they going to do? What's going to be the result? A classless society. Upper class, lower class, and we'll finally get to a classless society. It might take a couple of these processes, but eventually it's going to take place. Okay, anyway, that's the primary thing that liberation theologians read Marx for. Because Marx talks in good tools how the oppressed people are to struggle against the oppressor, and how, as a result of that, some sort of an alleviation or maybe even elimination of oppression is going to take place. It's the Hegelian dialectic, and Marx was sitting right at Hegel's feet learning all this. That probably means that it's time for us to... I told everybody they can't look at their watches, so don't you dare tell anybody. We spent the whole time listening to your laughing and clapping, but we want to know what's going on. So we're a little bit behind. And you're free to go anytime. If you want to follow the crowd out, that's right. That's fine to do. But anyway, if we can at least get those two things under our belts, that this isn't even an issue, this certainly has something to say to liberation theology, and this has lots to say. That people, if you're oppressed, you don't just sit there waiting for some sort of a super version, you know, some sort of a change from above. It's never going to happen. The only way that any improvement is ever going to take place is if we do something ourselves. We've got to struggle, and they can learn this from Marx, and they read Marx. Not a lot, you know that. We've just suggested that. But it's there, and it's important, and it's a part of their program. Now, let me throw one other at you. I've been in Mexico or Central America the last 2 January, so I've never celebrated it. I've always been out of the country. But what national holiday do we now have in January? Whose day is it? Martin Luther King. We've got a national holiday with this guy. Have you ever read anything by Martin Luther King? Have you? What? Everything I've read by Martin Luther King, he talks about Marx. Strive toward freedom, strength to love, on and on you go. Do you know what Martin Luther King says about Marx? Remember, he's a Christian. He's a Baptist. pastor. He's also such an important person that we have a national holiday now for him. But Martin Luther King, read the sixth chapter of his Strive Toward Freedom. He says, here are the people who have been most influential in my life. And he lists them. Jesus Christ, Gandhi, Reinhold Niebuhr, Walter Rauschenbusch, Karl Marx. Why? Why do you suppose Karl Marx was influential in Martin Luther King's life? And we don't wipe Martin Luther King out and divorce him and kick him out. I suppose some of us would like to, but the guy's a saint. And he appreciates in that sixth chapter, he says, Marx is one of the people that's most influential in my life. Anybody know why? What does Martin Luther King appreciate about, or what influence has Marx been in Martin Luther King's life?
He speaks to equality.
Equality and social concern. And Martin Luther King says, those are important aspects. And just because he says some other things that I don't like, doesn't mean that I throw him out. If he says some things that are true and important, I can acknowledge that those things have been influential and are important and ought to be embraced by all of us. Anybody that's got social concern or wants the lower classes to somehow be relieved from their oppression, those people we ought to listen to. We don't buy them lock, stock, and barrel, but at least we listen to that concern. In other books, such as his Strength to Love, he goes on and he preaches a whole sermon on the pros and the cons of Marx. That's okay to do. And liberation theologians do it too. They don't go around saying we all ought to be atheists, but they do say that there are some good things in Karl Marx that we need to learn from and that we need to incorporate because he's there. By the way, one other real quick example. Any of you Roman Catholic? Who's the most important theologian in the Roman Catholic Church? It was way back to the 13th century.
Thomas Aquinas.
Who did Thomas Aquinas borrow, use, introduce into his theology? And by the way, his theology is still, in spite of Vatican II, is still the as close as we can come to the official theology of the Roman Catholic Church today. But who did Thomas Aquinas introduce into his theology, into his systematics?
Aristotle.
Aristotle was 300 years before Christ. He was a non-Christian, right? He was an atheist, if we want to call him that. He didn't believe in Christ or the God that we know as Christians. And all of that is incorporated in a very important way into Aristotle's works. And everybody accepts it, and nobody's uptight. And what liberation theologians are saying is, why then in the world in the 20th century can't we look at and incorporate a few of the ideas of Karl Marx into our theology as well? Because Marx is talking about some things that really matter. That if we're going to eliminate this oppression, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to struggle. And Marx has some of those tools, some of the methodology. Okay? Make sense? Now, react real quickly. Are you still worried?
The bell for chapel.
Oh, it's time for chapel. As you're going, are you still angry that they use Marx? Are you still